that, I'll reconvene the hearing. Mr. Gerard, do you have any questions, Mr. Knott?
No, not really. I'm still struggling with the actual application of the guidelines as to what extent they can, someone can be forced to use them. At the moment, people are dealing particularly with them as guidelines, but they are forced to use them because there's a panel that says they have to. I mean, that's probably not fair to ask you about enforceability, but the council.
I think Mr. Price will have both confirmed in relation to the panel, but I think that's something different to, in a way, to whether an applicant has the easement or not in their application, and that is set by the district plan in terms of the activity status for development development, and if it's restricted discretionary activity is discussed for more than two dwellings and the low density zone or a development within the transition overlay, for instance, they have to work their way through them, and they will be used as part of the assessment of the application.
If you had an ideal world, for instance, I want to build a maritime, I've got guidelines, I'll have a look at them and go from there. But it's the person that's got a friend who's an architect in Auckland, and he's taking. I've got the section there, I can't design the house. When they get down there, I find that it doesn't quite work.
Yeah, when it comes down as to whether they have to choose the activity status or otherwise, ultimately.
Apart from the issue, the ends covered in one thing.
Now, I think these are questions to you. Because I take it that the actual text and the guidelines is largely your responsibility, is that?
I think rather than me take responsibility, I think I'd have to say the text and the guidelines is largely as a result of the work done in 2006.
Well,
and a lot of the work is still coming through 2006 with some editing. That's right, yes.
Yes, well, probably the matters I want to raise with you are probably. Matters, editorial matters that need consideration.
Yes, yeah, fine.
We go to page 21, and it's the neighbourhood one map.
Yes.
First thing I note is that all of the maps say, as listed in the district plan, March 2006. I'm just wondering if maybe something that you or Mr. Price could answer whether, in fact, these maps should refer to this district plan, not the district plan as it existed in 2006.
Correct.
I can't see the question.
Yeah. Right. So all of the maps will need to be adjusted in that respect. Second question I have is that. On the previous page, in 2.5.2.1, it refers to four views, 27, 29, 30, and 31.
No, I can't spot it either.
And that may be something that needs to be checked on the map. Whether it is actually in there and relevant or not.
Yes, it is. Ah, no, actually I've spotted 30. It doesn't help an awful lot, but if you go to the plan on page 23, that actually picks up 30. Yes.
Which could also be shown clearly on this one.
And just for cross-referencing purposes, plane 20 on page 51 also picks up on that same view shot from Buckingham Street. But refers to that as 26, view shaft 26.
Yeah, it was view shaft 30.
That you're looking at.
And on page 51, you can see part of the zero of 30.
Yes.
Yeah. I suppose was not the question to be asked there is view shaft 30, which is on the other side of the intersection and looking in the opposite direction, really a relevant view shaft for that neighbourhood?
I think probably, yeah, it's hard to, I'm just trying to double check.
There's no way to ask
it. Possibly not. Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the difficulty is, isn't it, with these view shafts, is it's not just from where the number's written, it's actually metres either side as well, isn't it? So.
Well, that was the next question. Are you familiar with the... I'm not sure if it's in the present Auckland Unitary Plan, but certainly in the previous Auckland Regional Policy Statement, the view shafts which were designated in that Regional Policy Statement?
Not in any great detail, but I'm aware of them, yes.
Yes. They identify a viewpoint and what has been viewed. I mean, they work to control height, so they're a different beast. But would there be value in Arrowtown with the views? There seems to be a large number of views which are suggested to be important, where maybe one overall plan might be helpful to show all of the views in one place to enable people to have a better understanding rather than having to dodge from plan to plan.
Yes, I mean, I think there could be some benefit in that certainly.
Well, we can move on from that.
Yes.
If we go over to page 23 to level 2 plan. Items 5 and 6 are described as being on a reserve, but it's not shown as a reserve. Is there any... the plan legend distinguishes between open space and reserves. Is there any reason for that reserve not being shown, or is that reserve not actually a public reserve, it's a private land?
I honestly don't know the answer whether it's a public reserve or not. I mean, I think Mr. Bice will confirm, because he had the closer liaison with the graphic designer who put the final document together. I think these large lands are entirely lifted from the previous.
I imagine they were.
Or effectively, they're based on 2015. Aerial photos. So there's been some updating, some drawing footprints, I think, in terms of the layer of information under the arrows, as it were, has been updated, but I think everything else pretty much remains as was the case. So, but I don't know whether that land's officially reserved under the reserve status or not.
Well, perhaps between you and Mr. Bryce, then, to be checked. Yeah.
And then on the map for neighbourhood 4, which was on page 27, and I may have missed it, but I couldn't find item 1. It lists St. John's Church, 26 Fletcher Street. I think the building might be there, but the number isn't attached to it.
Okay. Yeah.
And the other question in respect of this neighbourhood is in 2.5.5.2a, it says old school site redevelopment is one of the threats. Is that still the situation, or has that land been redeveloped in the last 10 years?
Yeah, I'd have to check on the date.
What term, sorry, so what term of reference was it?
2552A on page 26.
So, can it happen straight?
The map doesn't actually identify where that is, but there was a question given that I presume that was just transposed from the 2006 guidelines. Mm-hmm.
Whether it has been redeveloped.
Whether it's still the threat, yes, or it's been dealt with. There's another more general comment for both yourself and Mr. Bryce. It actually starts on page 6, but it's throughout the entire guidelines. It refers to the proposed MDR zone. If this is to be part of the operative plan, I can't talk about the proposed zone. That perhaps needs to be corrected. On page 61, in the existing vegetation section, got 371 guidelines B, and it says that trees lost, deemed unsafe at the end of their lifespan must be replaced, etc. Is there any guidance as to what would happen when trees are damaging property?
No, I don't believe that there is anything in there regarding that.
Should there be something?
That paragraph could be extended to address that issue, couldn't it? There's a further issue to encourage replanting if a tree is removed which is damaging the property.
Yeah.
And of course that may need replacement elsewhere, rather than in its original location.
Well, yes, because I mean, A says retain the vegetation identified in section 5. Some of that vegetation will become very large over time, given the species involved.
Yes.
It seems there's no provision in the guidance for dealing with that risk to property. When deemed unsafe, there's not a risk to property, that's it.
Yeah.
That's the person, human risk issue.
Yes, yeah. So, yes, potentially, I guess my response would be that paragraph B could be amended to address that issue.
Okay. Page 66, paragraph 313. in the very first paragraph, I think there might be a word missing, but if you could just check that first sentence and
is
it well, works about that to be encouraged?
Yes. Does that require a revision? I think it does, because as you pointed out, it doesn't quite make sense at the moment.
Those are my questions.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Love. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, sir. Yeah.
My name is Nigel Bryce, and I've been engaged by the Queensland Accessory Council to provide planning evidence to variation in one of the proposed digital plan, and as this relates to amendments to the provisions of the PDP to incorporate reference to the Arrowtown Design Guidelines 2016. Through variation one, the PDP applies the 2016 guidelines to the newer residential parts of Arrowtown, in addition to the Arrowtown Town Centre and the Arrowtown Residential Historic Management Zones. The 2016 guidelines are considered to be more effective at ensuring that development responds positively to Arrowtown's character than the previous 2006 version. This is particularly the case for the medium density residential zone in Arrowtown, which is located within close proximity to the Old Town residential area, also referred to, as I've just indicated, to the Old Town area. I recommend a number of specific amendments to the 2016 guidelines. I recommend amendments to the guidelines to reflect additional changes to accommodate new buildings over the last 10 years that were not included in the notified version of the guidelines, and to include amended neighbourhood plans for neighbourhoods 1, 2, 4 and 5. Further, Mr. Knott and I recommend changes to the introductory paragraph in section 4.8 to the guidelines, particularly guideline 4.8.2.3, to provide greater guidance around ensuring that the shape and form of new buildings within the medium density residential zone and the low density residential zone are broken up, and say that individual built elements or cells sizes are limited in scale to better reflect the shape and form of the cottage form found in the Old Town residential area. Consequently, the guidelines will better direct design outcomes that seek to reduce the overall mass of built elements into smaller individual components while maintaining the overall footprint for development within the medium density and low density residential zones. To this end, changes are recommended to section 4, which is the Old Town and New Town residential areas of the guidelines, to provide the following key amendments. And these are listed in my section 42A report, but I'll detail these now. So to amend the introduction to section 4, which is the Old Town, New Town residential area, to reflect recommended changes to the low density residential, medium density and the Old Town chapters, or the Old Town, Arrowtown residential historic management zone chapters. Amend the explanation to guideline 4.8.1 to remove repetition and to provide clearer guidance as to the shape and form of built elements within the medium density and low density residential zones. Amend guideline 4.3.1.2 to reflect recommended changes to the subdivision activity status for subdivision within Arrowtown. I mean, guideline 4.5.1.2 respect recommended changes to the medium density residential zone to include reference to the Arrowtown historic management transition overlap. Amend plan 3 to include reference to the transition overlay. Amend the medium density and low density figure 4 to remove reference to the primary elements and to refer to elements slash cells for houses in the new residential area. Amend the medium density residential figures 1, 2 and 3 to better reflect the individual elements or cell sizes anticipated within the medium density residential zone. And amend guideline 4.8.2.1 to reflect better cross-referencing to supporting medium density residential figures. And lastly, amend the guideline 4.8.2.3 to provide clearer guidance as to the maximum size requirements for individual element cells for development within the medium density residential and low density residential zones, and to delete reference to the adoption of cell sizes of cottages within the Arrowtown residential historic management zone. Collectively, these amendments to section 4 of the 2016 guidelines are considered to provide clearer guidance to users of the guidelines, and consequently, the 2016 guidelines are considered more effective. Following the filing of Section 42A report, further work was completed to update the town centre figures 1, part 1 and 2 in the 2016 guidelines. The updated figures attached to the memorandum of council dated 27 October 2016 replace those located on pages 68 to 71 of the guidelines. And Appendix 2 of the Section 42A report. I can confirm that I accept these amendments and support their inclusion in the 2016 guidelines. Further, the memorandum also highlights that two submitters, Mr. Mark Kramer, submitted 268, and Ready Group Limited, submitted 699, both submitted on Chapter 8, Medium Density Residential Zone. Given that their submissions relate to the 2006 guidelines, those parts of these submissions are deemed to be submissions against Variation 1. I understand, however, that only submission point 268.4 by Mr. Kramer is relevant to Variation 1, which supported the inclusion of the 2006 guidelines into the notified rule 8.2.6.1. I accept this submission in part on the basis that Variation 1 now replaces the 2006 guidelines with the 2016 guidelines. I do not make any specific changes to the provisions that provide reference to the 2006 guidelines that was sought to be amended as part of Variation 1 to the PDP. In relation to changes sought by Mrs. McLeod on behalf of the New Zealand Fire Service, she proposes amendments to the guidelines. I consider these have merit with the exception of the following amendments. You'll see my underlined reference to maybe appropriate as opposed to are appropriate reference in that particular guideline. And just in relation to the amendments that were made, so at the bottom of my page 2 of the summary, the two, well, the figures part 1 and part 2 on pages 68 to 71 relate to the Buckingham Street elevations, and they were specifically updated to include new buildings that have been developed since the 2006 guidelines were advanced, and the key changes relate specifically to the Postmaster's restaurant and the development that's occurred behind that, and at the other end of Buckingham Street, so behind the Arrowtown Bakery, the development that's occurred behind the bakery, and also behind the Saffron Restaurant. None of that development was referenced in the previous 2006 version of the guidelines. Thank you. Happy to answer any questions.
Thanks. I do have some. Thanks. In the Section 42A report, at 5.10. My mic fell off, excuse me. That's the least problematic wardrobe malfunction I suppose I could have. You've made reference to, firstly, the operative RPS, and you've made reference to the provision talking about protecting Otago's outstanding natural features and landscapes. I didn't quite understand how that related to the physical resource of Arrowtown.
Well, it doesn't relate directly to the physical resource, but I think it does inform the matters that we talked about earlier in relation to view corridors to those landscapes within key areas of the neighbourhoods. For example, in Buckingham Street, there are key, Buckingham Street, the town centre, there's key corridors, view corridors that are identified, linking to the adjoining outside.
Okay. So you're talking about public views from our town.
Correct, yes.
To those areas.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. At it's unnumbered, but it's running through the changes to the plan text you recommend. And I'm looking now at the proposed changes to Rule 8.4.11 in the medium density zone. And
is that a paragraph reference?
No, it's a proposed rule change, so it's a track change 8.4.11 in the plan.
I see, it's Appendix 2, is it?
Yep, Appendix 1, recommended revised provisions, but as I say, they're unnumbered. But I'm looking at the proposed changes to Rule 8.4.11, which, among other things, is updating the reference to the guide from 2006-2016.
Yes, so just to clarify, these are not recommendations that I've made. They've been carried through from the 42A officer reports.
Yeah, but we didn't really discuss too much about Arrowtown previously, hoping to do it in one consistent manner. But anyway, you might be able to help me, because what I wanted to ask was the wording that has been proposed in that bullet point for 8.4.11. And then if you turn the page to 10.4.4, there's a very different use of wording. And I just wanted to understand, as far as you know, whether there was any particular reason why reference to the guidelines been made in quite different manners, or whether it's just a quirk of when and who drafted the originals.
So Rule 8.4.11 relates to the medium density residential zone, and across the page Rule 10.44 relates to the residential
zone. Yes, I understand that. Yes. What I want to know is why in the medium density zone the discretion is restricted in a particular way that says consistency with Arrowtown's character using the guideline as a guide, and then in a different section of the plan, discretion is restricted to considering these matters shall be guided by the design guide. And I'm just wondering why, for what seems to be the same restriction of discretion, albeit in different zones, the council's proposed different wording. It may just be a quirk, or there may be a particular reason that I'm not able to ascertain.
And, sir, I'm not able to speak to those changes.
Okay.
But, yeah, I mean, clearly, if you're going to have discretion limited to a specific matter, there should be consistency, unless there is a reason for that change.
Commissioner, excuse me, I'll ask that that's not good.
Okay, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Yes. So then if we just work our way through the guideline, actually now before we go there, I'm still struggling a little bit with the council's thinking. I understand, especially through Mr. Knott's helpful answers, the significance of the guideline to Arrowtown and the significance of maintaining and enhancing the heritage characteristics of that settlement. What I'm not understanding is how, unless I'm mistaken, my wife tells me I'm frequently mistaken, but as I understand the situation, the most prevalent type of development likely in those greenfield zones where there's likely to be the most development happening, the guidelines aren't proposed to apply, which is permitted single houses on sites.
Correct.
And so I'm not understanding how, from a point of view of something like the guideline is needed, the options being everything is restricted discretionary, everything is controlled activity, everything is permitted with a permitted standard requiring some evidence of considering the guideline, through to do what you like, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
The council's analysis jumped to the least onerous do nothing in most cases. Now it may be that the council thinks there's going to be a lot more of the developments that trigger consent than I'm expecting, or in my mind I'm understanding. But I just don't see how the council got from saying the guideline's really important, therefore let's not make it apply most of the time.
Well, I think the key starting point is looking at the monitoring outcomes of the existing zone and the operative plan, which essentially inform the direction that the council's taken in the district plan review. So one of the key recommendations out of the old town residential and the low density residential monitoring wasn't the fact that the rules weren't working. In fact, it was indicated that the rules, with a bit of tweaking, were actually quite effective. But one of the things that was recommended was that the Arrowtown design guidelines were actually specifically referenced into the proposed district plan. Through the evolution of those specific chapters into the proposed district plan, there's been an inclusion of certain rules that reference to the guidelines, but that doesn't encapsulate all development activity, particularly in the low density residential zone, because my understanding is that other than the areas closest to the old town area, the council didn't feel that it was necessary to advance consent process for single dwellings in that zone, low density residential zone.
Have I got it right in my assumption, or is it a reasonable assumption that the majority of development likely in the medium density zone and low density zone would be detached or semi-detached houses?
Certainly in the low density residential zone it will be single residential standalone dwellings. It's likely that you will have attached units within the medium density zone. I think that's the intent, to provide for further intensification. So in the 42A report, where we deal with the issue, we're having to deal with a relatively small area of the low density residential zone that's close to the old town area. There are submissions seeking to provide for greater consideration of the guidelines and therefore changes to the rules to ensure that single dwellings are captured as well. Through the assessment in the 42A report and Mr. Knott's evidence, we don't feel that it's necessary to provide for a rule framework to address that small area of interface with the old town area. I think the way that the guidelines work, and I agree that there is a degree of confusion about the application across the entire area. It's certainly not a mandatory requirement that all development falls into the consideration of the guidelines, but through good planning practice or through good professional practice, it's hoped that the guidelines are considered by the architectural profession when dealing with issues to do with new dwellings in the low density residential zone. But in relation to single residential dwellings, it's not a mandatory requirement.
And the question arising from that is, let's just take the low density residential zone. If most of the development is expected to be detached single dwellings and there's a pathway to not meet the guidelines, what is the real effectiveness benefit of requiring it in those minority of instances where a consent is required, as opposed to just saying it's voluntary, look at it if you want to?
Mm. I think that the guidelines are trying to deal with development intensification, and where there are scenarios where you actually have development below the proposed recommended density provisions in the plan, it is appropriate for the guidelines to be considered. But I think it's only in relation to where you have development intensification below a certain threshold.
So my question is, if my site is smaller, but I have the same sized house, the same size front yard setback, might look exactly the same from the street, it's just that I've got a smaller backyard, what is the heritage significance of that density trigger to bring in the guidelines? So it's not about saying let's just take any opportunity to make the guidelines apply. What is the actual effects basis of using density as a trigger for the guideline?
Well, if you look at the Old Town area, I think the median density provisions is 800 square metres. I might counsel correct me if I'm wrong in the Old Town area. So straight away, if you're actually developing below the character elements of the Old Town area, you're creating more intensification. So development is going to look potentially different, especially if you're halving below that threshold. So I think it is an important consideration, particularly if that design outcome, because of a smaller lot size, results in a building which is very different in appearance. And if that's happening closer to the Old Town area, well, I think there is a resource management response that's required.
One of the things we explored at the previous residential hearings was what the plan actually meant by single residential dwelling. And it turns out that the 42A recommendation means it's a single house and a separate, or possibly separately detached, minor unit. So it's already what could appear to the viewer to be two separate buildings on a site that looks very much like two separate sites, albeit there's no subdivision title, which people don't experience as a physical thing anyway. So you're still comfortable that the permitted activity status of a single dwelling per site, which is actually two dwelling buildings for two independent households in terms of the plan's definition, albeit on one title, is sufficiently different from the same area of house, sorry, the same area of site, only I want to sell off the back house by way of subdivision, in terms of when the guideline trigger shouldn't apply.
Well, yes, I do think that those changes recommended in the 42A officer's report may lend themselves to being less transparent for plan administration. But taking a step back and looking at the intent of that rule change, I think given the confined nature of our town, you as a panel have to look at the issues around development intensification over the life of the district plan, which is the next 10 years. So I think what the office is trying to do is provide for a degree of flexibility around a single residential dwelling and flat to provide for some additional intensification. I'm reasonably comfortable that threshold is an appropriate trigger for the guidelines to kick in.
Do you think there's any risk of the requirement to consider a substantial guideline of substantial public interest by way of taking up, for instance, the medium density zones, higher density provisions? So I'll start again. Do you think that the requirement to consider the guidelines might become a disincentive for people to take up the density and intensification that the council is otherwise wanting to see in the medium density zone, if there's an after opportunity for them to completely ignore the guideline with a slightly lower density development?
No, I think that, development intensification or development per se in Arrowtown takes a long time. There's not been a lot of development, for example, in the town centre. And even the low-density residential areas have slowly filled up over the last 10 years. But I would imagine, given the confined nature of the urban boundaries, that if there is an attraction for further intensification, that it will occur over time. But I do think that there is a need for those guidelines to manage that interface, because this is a classic planning response dealing with the interface between two zones. And the changes to the guidelines, and it's for the panel to determine whether or not those changes are acceptable or not, seek to manage that interface issue through an appropriate design response. It's not lending itself to ensure that the medium density residential zone is a cottage form expressed on that zone. And that's some of the changes that have come through from submissions. But it's seeking to ensure that there is an appropriate response right at that interface to ensure that there's no adverse effects on heritage values of that old town area.
Yeah, turning to that recommended overlay at the edge of the medium density zone. In section 10 of the plan, the historic management zone, the proposed overlay in that zone is supported by a dedicated objective and policies explicitly justifying and enabling the overlay. No such specific objective or policies are proposed to support the new overlay in the medium density zone. They're relying instead on the general maintain and enhance the character of Arrowtown's special qualities. Do you think there's a consistency or administrative issue with the plan not being consistent in how overlays are set up in administration?
I think there, having just gone through a discussion on this in the Dunedin plan, 2GP plan, I absolutely believe that there's a need for consistency between chapters. If you're going to refer to a policy reference in one chapter versus another, and the way that Dunedin City Council references, they have a specific team of wordsmith policy planners that go through and ensure that any changes recommended from submitters are consistent with the overall framework that they've envisaged for their plan. And that's the type of approach that you'd want to achieve, I would imagine, through this plan.
In terms of the text of the guideline itself, Mr. Knock helped me with most of my questions, but there are just a few I'd like to put to you. And there may be a bit of repetition, so. On page 7, the first of many examples, at 1.5.5. Now let's put aside for now the question of whether that's actually one of the guidelines or not. But the use of the word must and the similar word shall is pretty common. Do you feel there's any potential confusion amongst users of the community about non-compulsory guideline using language suggesting that users must comply?
I don't think so. I mean, I think the intent of the guidelines are purely as a guidance tool to ensuring good development outcome. I mean, it does lend itself towards question that you asked Mr. Knott about whether or not certain guidelines need to be raised in hierarchy to ensure that they are achieving the end game.
Right.
So if that was the case, then perhaps the guidelines are tweaked to reference to those outcomes.
I can understand that. I think there's a perhaps greater indulgence of inconsistencies between planning documents when some are statutory and some are non-statutory. But where a document such as this is intended to be part of the plan, the expectation for vertical and horizontal integration is probably much, much higher. And so what struck me when I first read 1.5.5 is that I read that and I don't at all understand how it then leads to completely permitted activities throughout the low density and medium density zones, not needing to be compatible in character with historic features and context. When I read irrespective of scale must be compatible, pretty much means everything. And if that's not the intent, then perhaps there is some potential confusion. That's where I'm coming from. I understand your view that there isn't an issue, but But maybe you could just reconsider in light of how the plan doesn't in any way try and make projects irrespective of scale must be compatible in character with historic features and context, whether there might be a little bit of possible confusion.
Well, I think it takes a step back to the actual policy framework where the guidelines are actually referenced, where it talks about, and for example, the low density residential zone development being consistent with those guidelines. But not all development within the area town is actually applicable or by a rule framework.
I think what Commissioner Munro is asking you to consider is whether, in effect, the guidelines should express that.
So the reference to must be diluted so that it's less mandatory.
Or perhaps projects, irrespective of scale, where a resource consent is required.
Or in particular locations.
So users reading one document don't suddenly find another document say something manifestly different. Okay, anyway, thank you.
That's helpful, thanks.
What is your understanding, and it's the question that's put to Mr. Knott, of when a resource consent is required and one is considering the guidelines? Are there the coloured boxes chiefly being considered in terms of the guidelines, or is it the entire document that needs to be considered?
Well, I think, if I was informing myself about the heritage values of a particular area like Arrowtown as a planner, I wouldn't isolate my consideration of the documents to a particular chapter. I think I would read the entire document, particularly in relation to the front end section in terms of the history and background to Arrowtown, any relevance to the neighbourhood character areas of a particular part of the zone, and then delve into the actual mechanics of the chapter that was of particular relevance. Say, for example, the town centre, Arrowtown town centre section. Clearly, that has more relevance for someone considering development in that particular zone. However, if you're dealing with development in the medium density area, I do not believe that it would be good practice to singularly focus on the guidelines relating to that zone, because clearly there is an interrelationship between the two. And I think Mr. Knott answered that question where there's guidance that essentially requires you to consider the old town
yep.
area provisions.
Okay. So could you just turn to page 20 and just, as one example, I'm looking at 2.5.2.2, which is a list of threats. So there's A to F listed.
Yes.
Would they be matters that you think the council might consider when it's considering how a proposal might be appropriate in terms of the guidelines?
So neighbourhood one forms part of the old town residential
yep.
area.
So let's say I'm proposing a development in there and there's the blue boxes of guidelines.
Yes.
I'm asking, are these threats at A to F also effectively guidelines that the council would consider, or are they more background information helping inform people of the issues?
I think it's background information to inform. And that's, the structure as it's set out there is that as per the 2006 guidelines. And one of the things that we've been very careful not to do as part of our review is actually rewrite this entire guidelines. And I suspect if the council wanted to look at a full rewrite, the structure of this guideline would probably be very different.
Well, that in itself is one of the key questions in terms of taking an instrument that was designed as a non-statutory instrument across a range of acts and casting it in the role of a statutory instrument under one act, and whether out of necessity it should have fundamentally been reconsidered as a means of understanding or using it. You know, we're no longer saying it's a hammer, we're saying it's a drill. And maybe a hammer can't be used as a drill.
Well, I think it's important for the panel to be aware that the 2006 guidelines are actually referenced in the operative plan, but they're not referenced in the rule framework, referenced in section 4, the district-wide provisions, which I've referenced on my paragraph 5.18. So,
but the absence of a rule linkage effectively means they sit outside of the plan, unless you're considering a discretionary or non-complying activity where you can consider the whole plan.
That's right. So essentially, whilst they are embedded at a district-wide level in the policy, they form part of the overall consideration for discretionary or non-compliant activities. It's questionable whether or not you can then start enforcing that upon an applicant for other development.
Okay. My next question covers section 3.4 and 3.5 and 3.6 and bits of a whole bunch of other sections. But it's two things. One is are there links throughout the plan addressing public reserves and road reserves that would require the same attention given to the guideline by the council as it's asking private landowners to have? So that's a question in my own mind. I'm not sure if there's an underlying zoning for roads, for instance, whether the council wanting to do work in this park would have to look at the guideline, for instance, given that the guideline covers those quite things that's extensively. The second question is, if it doesn't, should they be removed from this guideline if it's just adding volume to applicants who don't even need to consider some of the stuff?
To answer your first question, so the original 2006 guidelines actually had a section on reserves, which has been removed. And that has been dealt with through a separate process. So I understand that the council is doing a reserve management strategy at the moment, and that the any reserve zoning may form part of stage two of the district plan review. In terms of dealing with issues to do with works within the road reserve, which aren't subject to any consent process.
Only because the council's proposed to not require resource consent of itself.
That's right, yes. I mean, I think it's adopted, my understanding is that it is adopted practice from the council's engineering team to consider heritage-related matters within the guidelines. And it comes back to ensuring that practice is not diluted through specifically deleting sections to do with street scene or works in road reserves.
Is there any confirmed resolution of the council or any department confirming that they will comply with the design guideline?
I can't answer that question. I'd have to come back to you today in terms of writing.
Yeah, that's fine. I think what's on my mind is that councils are legally required to observe their own district plans. And if we recommend to the council that it adopt a very unambiguous direction for how the public spaces of Arrowtown are to be or should be looked after, as part of that, I think we'd be looking for some confidence that in the absence of a resource consent mechanism, that in fact that method was going to be implemented. Otherwise, we might struggle to say we have confidence it can pass muster under Section 32. Mm. And while, yes, I think the council has absolute legal ability to, through its evaluation, say we don't need to use a reasonable consent in our roads because we think the LGA and LTMA will give us the ability to cover the same, get to the same place, that's fine. But I think we need to see that. I don't think we'd go as far as saying the council can just do what it likes and everyone else has to play by different rules. That might be a harder pill for us to swallow. I'm not suggesting that's what the council is proposing to us, but in the absence of us understanding how sections of the guideline that clearly don't relate to residential zoned private land, without understanding what, if any, weight they have, I'm sure you can appreciate it's hard for me to say, yes, let's put these things in the plan.
Yes, I mean, I appreciate that, but I mean, ultimately these matters are embedded in the 2006 version, which form part of the proposed district plan as notified.
But they'll be that the 2006 version, as Scott told us, is no longer extant because we've reached the same stage. The 2016 version is all we can be concerned with.
Mm. Yes. I mean, I think I would have some concern if, and I can say this, having done planning projects in Arrowtown for a long time. In fact, I was the original 42A officer that dealt with the redevelopment of the post office precinct development behind the postmasters in the early 2000s. If you deleted references to or guidelines that related to public space, even though it didn't, the applicant may not necessarily have any control over activities within that because it's a council-owned area, whether it be reserved land or public space on a road reserve. I still believe that it's important for development to be guided by guidelines that deal with those particular issues, because clearly there's no, you can't just say this is my legal boundary and not have consideration of the interface between private and public space, particularly if you're dealing with commercial buildings that have a function that relates to that reserve area, or has a function that relates to addressing a road, a public area like a road.
But in the absence of clear commitment and confirmation from the council that it will abide by the guidelines for those public spaces, how can any private person trying to develop their land have any confidence in anything the guideline says about those areas? Which was the point of the previous question.
Yeah. I mean, I take the concern you have in relation to the fact that there's nothing in front of you that says the council will do this on its own public space or reserve land or road reserves. But I think the key point is that there has been consideration of these guidelines. They appear to have worked in the past in terms of guiding good practice, in terms of how development relates to these open areas.
It is common in plans to have provisions that bind the council, most notably rules requiring what shall not be notified, for instance. Mm. Do you think if we supported the guideline and those submissions that support it so much, subject to the scope of submissions and assuming we felt it was, if we recommended adding a policy saying the council shall observe its guideline in public spaces, would that be an appropriate thing for us to do?
My thoughts are that it may not necessarily be necessary at this stage. It may be that those issues are dealt with at stage two as part of any changes to zoning that occurs as part of stage two of the district plan.
Just before you finalise your answer, are you aware of the council's submissions in stream 7 related to designations with council has examined the status of roads in the district plan and concluded that they're neither designated nor zoned.
I'm not aware of that.
Would you like to frame your answer in the knowledge of that circumstance then, please?
So they're neither designated nor zoned.
Precisely.
So if they're not zoned, how could you integrate a policy and rule framework that deals with those under the district plan?
Well, the first question is, would the provision of the Act that says where a consent is required and it's not described in a plan, it's a default discretionary activity, would that apply? And then would it not?
Well, there's Section 9, which says everything that's not otherwise mentioned is permitted.
I mean, I think the issue is that we're dealing with a guideline that is embedded in the proposed district plan. These are broader questions in terms of the effectiveness of the guidelines as it relates to roads or reserved land. Particularly in relation to reserved land, that's something that can potentially be dealt with through stage two. But I don't think that I'm in a position to inform a rule framework to address that particular issue. I think it's probably best that that is dealt with as part of those specific zones.
Do you think that
It would be obviously clearer and easier for plan administration if there was a specific reference to how the council was looking at wanting to manage or deal with resource management issues as it relates to roads. But if that's not the case at the moment, it needs to be possibly looked at.
It's pretty clear at this point that the proposed guideline is intended to serve a wider purpose for Arrowtown and its community than just an assessment tool for residential development within residential zones. I don't think there's any way that can be denied, because the guideline goes well beyond that, those matters. And that's not a criticism. But my question is, do you think there would be a benefit or reason in support of some measure or process, or however it was done, through the guideline that actually made it clearer what bits were relevant to people who wanted to prepare an application for consent on their sites, and what weren't?
I mean, I think if you were going to provide a key piece of, because the guidance is so large, it's quite voluminous, it would probably be helpful to have almost like a consent checklist at the front end that indicated that if you did require a consent, this is how the guidelines worked. And I think that's the key point if you require a resource consent.
Yes, my interest in this particular line of questioning is the fact that it's a restriction of discretion. Yes. And consent could be refused to me as an applicant, having spent $500,000 on top-notch consultants addressing what I thought was the relevant bits of the guideline, only be told in fact that I haven't done a landscape plan for a whole bunch of wider streets beyond my site, and therefore I'm having my consent refused.
Yes,
and not understanding that is something that I'm, in my mind, struggling to get over in terms of the administration of the guidelines in that statutory context.
Well, I was just looking at that point, because obviously that relates to your earlier comments relating to the checklist and section 5.6. at the bottom of page 175.
Yep.
Now, I haven't explored whether or not that last point is actually that helpful, because you're in a town centre zone, and I'm not sure, unless you're dealing with development that starts to impact on view shafts, that you would even need a landscape assessment. So, I mean, it's a valid point that you've raised, but I think the intent of these guidelines, or this checklist, is to essentially ensure that the resource consent information that you advance is broadly consistent with the level of information that's been considered as being appropriate for development in certain areas of the Arrowtown. For example, the the town centre applications that I've seen in the past have been very comprehensive and go into a lot of detail in terms of their relationships with areas like public open space or how they relate to open space or colour scheme or material palettes. It's all guided by these checklists and the content of the guidelines. I think there is value in these checklists, but I take your point about the issue about a landscape architect. I don't know why that is even relevant unless you've got a building that's over height and is starting to impact on those key view corridors.
So do you want to turn to page 182 while we're on the topic of checklists? So if we look at item number 4, site planning and design, mm-hmm. and this is now for new development in the low density and medium density zones. So for instance, the third item under number 4, garages, driveways, parking areas and parked vehicles will not dominate the street. Isn't that fundamentally a matter of assessment for the consent, not a box you tick that says I've done it, therefore easy peasy, in my view, I won't dominate the street. How do you tick that off? And if it's ticked off, does that mean the council shouldn't assess it any further because the applicant thinks they've ticked it off?
Well, I mean, the value of the checklist is just to either guide the consultants or the applicants to ensure that their applications are suitably robust and deal with those issues. I mean, if you're dealing with a development in the low-density residential area, garaging is actually quite an important issue.
Oh, yeah, that's through the guideline. So let's just take in that 5.9, that matter. So I work through the checklist. Mm-hmm. If I work through the checklist, should I have confidence, subject to the council experts agreeing or disagreeing, and there's an arm wrestle about what's dominant and what's not, but if I address all the matters on the checklist, would I, as an applicant, have reasonable confidence that the council wouldn't come back to me with a request for something else that's not on the checklist but is described in the guidelines?
I think the guidelines and the checklist, I mean, the whole package works together, but I think the checklists are there to actually inform applicants whether or not professional consultants or whether or not they're just lay people as to what would be standard practice.
Okay. Let me put it another way. For the purpose of new development in the low density residential zone or the medium density residential zone, mm-hmm. is the checklist at 5.9 on effectively one page, is that not actually the key guidelines? Are these items, this checklist?
They pick up on the threads of those guidelines.
So would there be a benefit for users in the plan directing people to the very pointy end of the pencil? These checklists are the key things that have to be dealt to. The remaining 179 pages help explain how you get there.
Well, it comes back to my earlier comment that it would actually be helpful to have a succinct statement linking back to, for plan users, this is how you read these guidelines. If it's not clear to someone who has looked at this afresh, clearly there is a need to provide that succinct level of guidance right at the very front end.
Okay.
So I do agree with you that it would be helpful to link plan users back to those checklists.
That's all for me. That was all.
We've reached 1 o'clock. I'm just wondering, I've got a few questions. Mr. Price, do you have any questions for me? I'm not asking for I'm just asking if you have any questions.
Not like now.
I'm just wondering whether if we adjourn and have a half hour lunch and reconvene at 1 might be appropriate. Is that Secretary Miss Scott? presumably don't want to stay
the entire day.
Yeah,
you
say it's fine. It's 1 p.m. now, so...
Yes, I know. That's why I've asked the question.
Yeah, so resume at 1, did you? Mm. Is that correct?
Yes, that's fine. Okay. I'll adjourn until 1:30.
I think my back is not
bad. Oh, no worries.